Everything in South Florida is reopening, but there are still many restrictions. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last week, the governor said the state is entering phase three, the final stage of reopening. We'll take a look at what that means moving forward and the restrictions that still exist, like mask wearing. Also, a federal court ruled in favor of the Trump administration recently, and now hundreds of thousands of immigrants living in the U.S. under temporary protected status may have to return home. We'll learn more about the ruling and the state of immigration court. Finally,
I think what makes the manta rays so unique about Florida is that no one really knows that they're here.
Have you seen manta rays swimming around Palm Beach County? Well, it's not an accident. We'll hear from the researcher who's found dozens off our coastline in the past couple of years. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. It was a much different scene Saturday night in downtown Fort Lauderdale, Miami's Wynwood neighborhood, and in West Palm Beach. Bars and nightclubs reopened their doors for the first time since March as Governor Ron DeSantis moved the state into phase three.
But I would just tell people, you know, the fact that you continue to move forward with the economy, it doesn't mean that, the virus disappears. And so people should just understand it's something that we're going to have to deal with.
Well, he made the announcement on Friday from a news conference at an empty restaurant in St. Petersburg, noting the economic toll the pandemic has put on many small businesses. The executive order also limits the ability of local governments to restrict business activity and enforce social distancing and mask requirements. Joining us now is the Miami Herald state government reporter, Anna Ceballos. Anna, great to have you back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Anna, let's review the phase three reopening. What was Governor DeSantis' justification for now allowing bars and restaurants and more retail to open at full capacity?
So the clip you just played is pretty much a snapshot of what his justification was. The governor said that while the pandemic is, you know, far from over, the threat has eased, and that the economic harm that COVID-19 related closures to restaurants and businesses have actually posed a bigger threat to society in general by leaving people without work. And, you know, in his executive order, for example, he explicitly said that Florida has, quote, suffered economic harm and that closures have exacerbated the impact of the public health emergency. And because of this, he's saying that local governments shouldn't keep Floridians from working or operating their businesses. And he kind of compared the six-month closures as a way of leaving people twisting in the wind, he said. And over the past several months, he's, you know, been emphasizing that the threat of mental health, of people being out of work as a result of these closures, have been a problem. And so that was the justification that he made.
And he did mention again the fact that the virus didn't go away. It's not gone yet. And just to note, the state has had now more than 700,000 total cases. With this new phase three, I mean, what can local governments do? Can they continue to restrict the number of people that are allowed in businesses?
So the short answer is yes. Governments can, even though the executive order preempts all local rules, municipalities can still make the case, right, for some restrictions, but they have to justify the economic and health reasons for limiting a business from operating or at a certain capacity. For example, if a municipality says that restaurants cannot operate at full capacity indoors, it would have to explain to the state why that limitation is necessary for the public health of the community and quantify the economic impact of limiting the capacity at that restaurant, which could be, you know, detrimental to employees or the employer.
Yeah. And that's what's happening in South Florida. What about any fines and penalties for not adhering to social distancing protocols and mask wearing? What about that?
So the order says that fines, fees, and all penalties really tied to the local COVID rules are suspended or were suspended as of Friday afternoon when he signed the order. But that means that it's rendering many of the rules toothless, meaning, you know, that there's really not much of a punishment for individuals if they break any social distancing rules, leaving, you know, governments in this awkward position. The governor said that he was suspending fines and fees as a, quote, act of executive grace. He said that he hopes people can work collaboratively to abide by the rules rather than to have fines and fees or penalties attached to them. And, you know, this came also like a few weeks after the governor ordered all 67 counties to send his office all the mandates and penalties that they had in place. He got a copy of all those orders, supposedly September 15th. So we don't really know. We haven't seen all those penalties, but I'm sure maybe he made this move after seeing what, I don't know what the penalties were at each of the 67 counties, but maybe that had something to do with it.
Yeah. What have we heard from public health experts, you know, epidemiologists about this now phase three?
Well, you know, we did hear from, his name is Dr. Tom Inglesby, and he's an infectious disease and pandemic expert at the Center of Health Security at Hopkins, Johns Hopkins University. And he said he was surprised that the state was lifting more restrictions on businesses when parts of the state had have ongoing cases above what federal officials consider acceptable. He said that it was worrisome that, you know, that all these restrictions are now being lifted when we're trying to safely have kids and college students return to campus instead of just, you know, pacing things. And, you know, Florida over the weekend just passed the 700,000 mark of COVID cases since the start of the pandemic in March. So this is kind of, you know, like the state still has seen a significant amount of disease in the state. And he said that laxing all these rules kind of sends a message, you know, to the younger people that, you know, isolation will, might potentially be harder if there is a spread of the disease due to these restrictions being lifted.
Yeah. And again, just as a reminder, we are in phase three, but the virus has not gone away. By the way, we have invited Carlos Jimenez, mayor of Miami-Dade County, to join us on the program. Hopefully we'll hear from him this week, because of course Miami-Dade still has the highest number of cases. But you know, Anna, did the governor give any indication about the thresholds that would need to be in place to stay in phase three?
No, he did not. But he did make clear, you know, that the state is not closing again. He said that moving forward, the state is prepared to fight the infections if they increase again, but in terms of businesses closing, but
what does that, what does that mean? Fighting? What does that mean? Fighting? We're not going to close, but we're going to keep fighting this. So if the numbers all of a sudden started spiking again,
well, you said that the infrastructure, right? Like the state is prepared to deal with it if it happens, but he didn't really give many specifics. It's just been more of the, listen, you know, we have hospitals, we have experts that we're going to handle this no matter what, but we're not closing again.
Yeah. Again, I'm speaking with the Miami Herald state government reporter, Anna Ceballos. Florida now in phase three of the reopening, which means bars, nightclubs now can reopen, gyms, restaurants can have full capacity. And we've included more of the governor's reopening plan on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And the other thing, too, you've been following the fight to slow the spread of the coronavirus on college campuses. It's proven extremely different in communities like those at UF, at the University of Florida, Florida State University. What policies do they have in terms of tracking the virus and trying to crack down on parties and a lot of big social events?
So university presidents have been sending their messages campus-wide that, you know, if you break social distancing guidelines that the university have in place, like avoiding large parties, or, you know, if you tested positive, you don't, in order to isolate, if you break that isolation requirement, you could be suspended for at least a semester. And so there, you know, the balance is, what do you do with on-campus housing when, you know, that's the jurisdiction of the university versus off-campus housing? So they're partnering with local law enforcement at cities and these college towns to really crack down on large parties that are being held by my college students.
And how are the students responding? I mean, wondering, you know, one, how are they finding that balance between, look, you got to be safe, but you're in college, you're a college student, and you want to socialize. What are you hearing?
Well, I interviewed a few students here at FSU and UF up north in Florida, and they were, you know, they're trying to recreate that college experience. They said that they were part of the reason why they came back to school was because their parents wouldn't let them out. And once they got here, they were avoiding large parties and wearing masks. But at the same time, they were still having indoor gatherings. I talked to one who tested positive with 10 of his friends. And, you know, he was saying, you know, like, yeah, I mean, the narrative that is out there that young people will fare out better with the disease kind of made me be more relaxed with my he put his guard down, basically, by not being too strict. And, you know, he said that the worst thing he had was a headache. But at the same time, you know, they're still going to Publix and they're going out in the community to grocery shop. And that's the concern of what threat does this pose to the more vulnerable communities if there is big spread in campus communities.
And of course, we'll be looking more into what that threat is, as again, everything is now starting to reopen. We are in phase three, so it seems like we're trying to get back to business. The Miami Herald state government reporter, Anna Ceballos, joining us today. Anna, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
No, of course. Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Still to come, a recent court ruling impacts the temporary protected status for hundreds of thousands of immigrants. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants living legally in the U.S. could face deportation as early as next year after a federal court ruled in favor of ending their temporary protection. This affects TPS holders from El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan. TPS protects immigrants fleeing war or natural disasters from deportation and allows them to work in the U.S. The Trump administration has been trying to end TPS for people from six countries for years, and this latest ruling brings that reality closer. Joining us now is Jose Miguel Cruz. He's the director of research at FIU's Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center, joining us now via Skype. Jose, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So at issue, Jose, is the termination of temporary protected status. Remind us what that status means and who's eligible, who gets it.
Well, the people who get these status are people who, because of reasons of natural disasters or political commotion in some countries, they get this temporary protection status, right? Salvadorians have been the largest group for many years. They got this, most of them got this status in the early 2000s. After earthquakes hit El Salvador in 2001. But then also Haitians have gotten after the devastating earthquake in 2010. So they have benefited from this status for many years now.
And, you know, does that TPS have a path to permanent residency or citizenship?
No, it doesn't. So it just provides a temporary, as it says, it's a TPS, is a temporary protection status that basically when the government decides to end it, the people who have benefit have to go back to their countries or they have to move into another immigration status.
So let's go back a couple of years. The Trump administration terminated TPS designations of El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan. TPS recipients and their families responded with a lawsuit. On what grounds were they fighting the termination of TPS?
Basically on the ground that going back to their countries, specifically in the case of El Salvador and the case of Haiti, these countries were in no condition to accept the massive return of immigrants, right? They were still reeling from, you know, the fallout, the consequences of the earthquakes, the natural disasters. And in the case of El Salvador, there was some argument saying that the conditions in El Salvador, because of high levels of violence and some kind of political instability, put them in danger were they to return to their country. And in the case of Haiti, sorry.
No, I'm just going to say, Jose, do you think they have a strong case?
El Salvador have been for many years one of the, you know, most violent countries in the world. Not even in the Western Hemisphere, but in the world, due to violence, gangs, you know, the notorious and infamous MS-13 is based in El Salvador. So, to some extent, they do have a case about that. Yeah.
All right. So they have this again, this lawsuit, and it was strong enough for them to be granted a preliminary injunction, and that was lifted in this month's ruling from the Federal Appeals Court. So, what's the significance of this latest ruling?
The significance is that now the government can proceed to basically start removing these people from the country. Now, because of previous arrangements, some countries or nationals from some countries have 120 days after any ruling to be able to be removed from the country. In the case of El Salvador, because of some arrangements between the U.S. government and the Salvadoran government, I think they have around 12 months for this to happen. So they have some time still in order to be removed. And but still, this is hanging over, you know, the future, obviously, and this obviously will have consequences for them.
Yeah, and can they appeal?
They can appeal, and I understand that there are several groups, basically several advocates of immigrants are moving in order to appeal this decision. Yeah.
I understand there's a separate injunction issued by a New York federal judge. Does that provide protection for the Haitian TPS holders?
No, not that I know at this point. I will have to check on that. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. Now, a lot of these TPS holders have lived in the U.S., as you mentioned, I mean, years, a couple decades, and they have children here. What kind of decisions will these families have to make if the ruling stands and deportations begin?
Well, I mean, as you said, they have children. Some of them they have married with citizens. They have put down roots here in the United States. So they have to look for another way to remain here in terms of to normalize their legal status. Otherwise, this means the separation, more separation of these families, and going back to these countries that are in no condition to receive them. So most of the recommendations from the specialists in immigration is that those who have been in beneficiaries of TPS should be looking for alternatives to normalize the situation here.
I'm speaking with Jose Miguel Cruz, the director of research at FIU's Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center. Hundreds of thousands of immigrants living legally in the U.S. could face deportation as early as next year. This after a federal court ruled in favor of ending their temporary protection. The ruling affects TPS holders from El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan. Jose, are there any concerns, or how would the government go forward with these deportations while we're dealing with a pandemic?
Well, we have to see what the government will decide. Obviously, the current administration is eager to deport as many immigrants as possible. However, because of the conditions, because of the pandemic, There are some provisions that allow people to apply for a sort of extension, right, when they have been legally here in the United States. We have to see whether, well, how the DHS, Homeland Security will deal with that, will interpret that. But as I said before, because of previous arrangements, those who are facing the end of their status, they still have 120 days to be able to be removed. And in the case of Salvadorians, that can take as long as 1 year.
And I wanted to ask you about that. So El Salvador has the highest number of TPS recipients. And as you said, they have the longer window to be able to stay here, up to 12 months. Why is that?
This has to do with some, I think, conversations between the U.S. government and the Salvadorian government. Some kind of agreement between the government of these two countries that allows Salvadorians to have more time to prepare for the end of their status.
And you also mentioned, because again, the argument from the administration is they can return home, it's fine. And yet we've seen there are a lot of issues in these countries, like El Salvador. Things have gotten bad, haven't they? Even worse,
and they're gonna get worse if we consider the fallout of the pandemic, right? These are all these countries: El Salvador, Nicaragua, Haiti, Sudan. These are poor countries with high political instability, with high levels of violence, and the pandemic and the economic crisis coming from the pandemic will worsen those conditions. So these in no way are good news for those who have benefit from the TPS. And I think the way forward should be a solution that take into consideration the situation on these countries and the situation of the immigrants.
So, I mean, Jose, advocates for lower immigration to the U.S., they welcome the ruling, and they argue that the generosity of this emergency status has been taken advantage of. Is there an argument to make there?
I don't think so, because as I said, I mean, if we consider the situation in El Salvador, in Haiti, in Nicaragua, these countries are in really bad shape. And many of them, basically, if they go back to their countries, they not only face, problems of scarcity and poverty, but especially their own survival with the situation as bad in some areas in Haiti and El Salvador.
And all of this comes just barely 50 days, less than 50 days before the election. Do you see immigration as being a key issue in this election? Is you like up there with the COVID, the Supreme Court, the economy, or is it going to be pushed back?
I think there's certainly the next administration will have to deal with the issue of immigration, and whatever this administration is, whether it's Trump or is the Biden administration, I don't think that's a priority in the campaign right now, in the discussion. But it certainly should be, because many of these countries, some of these countries, Nicaragua, Haiti, El Salvador, these are neighboring countries to the United States. And to the extent that situations are not fixed in these countries, this country will continue sending immigrants to the United States, and any solution should go through a comprehensive immigration policy in the next administration.
Jose Miguel Cruz is the Director of Research at FIU's Kimberly Green Latin American and Caribbean Center. Jose, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what's the experience like for immigrants going through the court system now? I want to turn over to Michael Vasteen. He's the professor of law at St. Thomas University. He's also the director of the school's immigration clinic and has been working with clients during the pandemic. Michael, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You've been working remotely to advise your clients during this pandemic, and these are clients both on detention and not detained, but part of the reason you've been conducting these calls remotely is because the courts don't satisfy the constitutional standards for safety, right?
Yes, so we've got a convergence here of some of this makes us get in the weeds on the details of the detention system and the immigration court system, but so we have a vast population, 30 or 40,000 strong, that is in mandatory detention throughout the country. And because these immigrant detainees are also in their court proceedings, it presents special challenges for litigating their cases in front of the immigration court. So locally, downtown, the Miami court has, I believe, 27 judges, and the detention center courts have 5. The downtown courts have been closed since the spring, but the detained courts have continued going forward. And so, as you alluded to, there's challenges for them to put their cases together from detention, where their counsel and their witnesses are reluctant to go into the detention centers themselves.
It's been well reported by our news partner, the Miami Herald, the safety concerns facing immigrants in detention centers. Hundreds testing positive at the Chrome Detention Center last month, and they were forced to go to the court proceedings regardless of the diagnosis. Have any of your clients contracted the virus or been in contact with somebody who has?
Yes. And so how this has worked is we have clients that are detained in the Glades Detention Center up in Moorhaven. And because they have to appear before the court in Miami via televideo, there's a special room that they would go to do their appearances, even at their trials. And, you know, they are scheduled for a trial several weeks in advance. But if at that date of their hearing, the health conditions were such that the facility didn't think they could properly and safely transport them to the special hearing room, then their case would be continued, reset for several weeks further out in the future. So you can imagine how disconcerting that is to the detainee who is in an environment that's not safe enough for them to get to the room to complete their hearing so they can hopefully leave detention, and instead they find themselves detained for several more weeks to wait for their hearing.
What's your understanding of the conditions in these facilities? How sanitary are they? Are these folks being kept safe?
This would not be my opinion. This would be the opinion of the judge hearing the case in the Southern District of Florida, because, of course, there was a lawsuit here in addition to lawsuits around the country about the conditions. But the case that's pending before Judge Cook in the Southern District found that it was really impossible for the detention centers to maintain their normal populations and do any proper sequestration of the consort of detainees that had contracted COVID, because they're living communally. It's a large open space, bunk beds with 30 or 40 detainees in the common room, shared restrooms and other facilities. So the judge believe that DHS would have to limit its lower its population by about 75% in order to have any hope of the proper distancing, not to have guaranteed transmission. But she noted all these cases that said that these circumstances give rise to conditions that are violating the Eighth Amendment to be free from cruel and unusual punishment, because being sitting ducks to contract COVID in that environment it raised serious constitutional questions.
Yeah,
that she was looking to monitor.
In cases where clients are at risk of deportation, I'm wondering about the legal considerations for the host country. So we were talking with our last guest about, you know, the end of TPS, and, you know, like thousands of Salvadorans might have to go back home. But El Salvador would need to agree to receive them, right?
Right. And so I haven't heard of a Salvadoran example, but there was an example that received a fair amount of attention in the press where some ICE Air flights, I think it was ICE Air, so it was all detainees being flown down to Guatemala, then triggered what was then traced back into, I don't know if we characterize it as a super spreader event, but there was definitely they were able to trace back to the detainees, then introducing some volume of COVID to the home country. So again, yeah, you're exactly on, right that the home countries are looking out for what is being what risk is being deported to them. And we have one parallel example of someone who is entitled to come back after being removed in his home country. The delays in being able to process that person's return, just like all aspects of the immigration system and these understandings between countries of which countries' populations present the higher or lesser risk.
I'm speaking with Michael Vasteen, professor of law at St. Thomas University. We are discussing immigration court during COVID-19. Michael, I mean, is that the one you were just talking about? Is that you have one client stranded in Jamaica, right? Is that the one you were talking about?
Yes.
Okay. Help us understand the circumstances. What's going on right now?
This happens sometimes where someone is removed but is entitled to come back. And like in this example, I'm not disparaging the people from DHS that are trying to help us bring him back, but it shows that how the intersection with COVID has escalated some common recurring problems. If someone who's entitled to be back in the U.S. because it turns out that they do hold their resident status, so they're allowed to be on U.S. soil, but then something happens like this pandemic that prevents them from being able to do it. You could think of any number of circumstances where just the practice of the immigration courts or the treatment of immigrants has been changed or escalated from this. People are detained where they are detained, not necessarily close to where they're from. So their contact with their family from detention is often during video. But what if they have to have their individual hearing and they want to call witnesses? And the witnesses are out of town or the witnesses are elderly. At the beginning of the pandemic, I think we were not set up well to fully accommodate the telephonic appearances of people that were far-flung that needed to participate in the cases. I think it's come better. Now there's even a standing order with the local detention courts for attorneys to appear telephonically. Of course, it's much harder to give a full presentation of the humanitarian aspects of your client's case when sometimes they're not present. They're via video and the attorney isn't present to really feel the room and the witnesses are appearing via telephone.
Is this indicative of individuals who are stuck in that same situation as your client in Jamaica? They're stuck abroad. They're trying to get back in the U.S. Is this basically what they're all going through?
I think that's a relatively small population of his specific situation, but I think that it goes the other way too with, I imagine ICE is having extensive problems keeping up its removal schedule because of that exact situation. They have a client that's up in Wakulut Detention Center near Tallahassee, and he contracted COVID a few weeks ago and said that it was just something that he and the people that he was being detained with were sweeping through their group. It was just the reality. He was certain that he would get it eventually, and then sure enough, he did.
We know there's a backlog of cases building because the downtown Miami Federal County has closed for months now. It's expected to reopen October 16th. Do you think that judges are going to try to move quickly through and process as much as possible, or what do you think they're going to do?
Well, the judges are in an interesting situation. They haven't been able to hear these cases. It was well publicized when Jeff Sessions was Attorney General that the judges were put onto a quota system where they have to close at least 700 cases a year. And so I would assume that they will get a reduction for the time that they haven't been able to hear cases. But I think that when they're back, there's going to be an expectation that they get back to as soon as possible to those pre-COVID expectations. So this quota system, it brings up opens up the door for another discussion of just how they can manage their dockets. Because a lot of things have happened to these cases over the last 6 months. Some may be less ready to proceed for the reasons I brought up earlier, that it's hard to have a good client relationship when you can't see them, et cetera. There's going to be just a new reality when the court reopens. But the court certainly will be under its pre-COVID pressures to move cases forward. and they have less docket control than they did prior to this administration. So they've got less, they're significantly more restrained on what cases they can give even extensions to, and the judges have no ability to completely close cases, and the government does not have a model for exercising prosecutorial discretion. So I would assume by, looks like at least, well, they'll be closed through October 16th. Thereafter, we'll see how they rebound.
What indications do we have from the acting ICE director or from the Trump administration directly that there are plans to fast-track deportations and proceedings?
Well, I think we've seen their position in the courts, in which they the government won a recent major court case that ended an injunction where they could impose expedited, broaden expedited removal, which was a process that went outside of the immigration courts that previously was only applied to people that had been arrived recently to the U.S. and they were found close to a border within 100 miles of any border. Now, this expedited removal process has been applied nationwide. And that's a tool to get cases out of the immigration court system, which, of course, reason the judges are on quotas is because there's a criticism that perhaps they weren't moving cases fast enough. Of course, cases that are life and death or determining whether someone is removed from the country they've lived in for years are serious matters, and it takes several hours to get to the bottom of those. And if a judge closed 700 cases a year, that would require, I believe it's, you know, at least three a day, and whether that is reasonable or possible has been the subject of much debate.
Have you seen judges respond differently with clients depending on where they're coming from? For example, like if you have people coming from places like Venezuela or El Salvador, maybe they treat them differently or just deal with it differently than maybe from somewhere else?
I don't think there's really particularly country-specific changes. I guess locally we would have the phenomenon of Cuban adjustment cases and just the tension between Cuban arrivals having a particular program that they would be able to avail themselves of if they were present for more than a year, with the tension being that if they wanted to apply for asylum, they would have to apply for that in less than a year. So that creates a tension that historically would play out here in South Florida more than anywhere else, where some of those cases need a little bit more time to go through the easier remedy.
Yeah. A lot to talk about here. I'm going to have to end it on that note, though. Michael Vasteen, professor of law at St. Thomas University, again, director of the school's immigration clinic. Michael, thanks so much for the insight.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, still to come, there are more manta rays swimming in South Florida waters. Why is that? And what should you know about these majestic creatures? All that coming up. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Swimming or boating in South Florida, you may have been fortunate enough to see a dolphin, maybe a manatee, lots of things swimming out there. You might have also seen some large, flat, diamond-shaped fish near the shore recently. In Palm Beach County, there have been dozens of juvenile manta rays swimming right off the coast. Jessica Pate is the founder and lead scientist of the Florida Manta Project at the Marine Megafauna Foundation. She spent the past 3 years studying this population, and she's found strong evidence that South Florida has a nursery ground for these manta rays, and it's only the third that's ever been found in the world. You can read her story in National Geographic on our social media. We spoke with her last week. Jessica, I want to start with this. When you think of all the megafauna in South Florida, sharks, whales, manatees, everything, what makes the manta ray such a unique population here?
I think what makes the manta rays so unique about Florida is that no one really knows that they're here. There's very little awareness about them. Like, you go to the beach and you see signs about the sea turtles. You're not supposed to swim with the dolphins or approach the whales. And all these things are very well known. You have manatee speed reduction zones. But there's no information about manta rays here. And the average Floridian doesn't even know that we have them in Florida's waters.
And can you describe them? I think we know, but just remind us, what does a manta ray look like?
They're different than your typical stingray that usually lives on the bottom. Manta rays are always swimming through the water. They have to keep swimming to breathe. And they're kind of diamond-shaped and very dark black on the top. They're dark black on top with some little white patches on their shoulders. And then on the bottom, they're white with black spots. And those black spots on their bellies are unique to each individual, which we researchers use to study them. And then one of their most distinctive features is they have fins coming out from their face. They have two fins on each side of their mouth, and these are called cephalic fins, and they use these fins. They can unroll them and roll them up, and they're unrolled. They use to funnel water into their mouth when they're feeding.
What got you interested in the manta ray?
It actually happened very much by chance. I moved down to Florida after my undergraduate degree to study sea turtles. So I was on the beaches conducting nesting surveys every day. And while I was out on the beach, I would sometimes see these rays swimming by in just like 3 to 5 feet of water. And there are manta rays. And I was a diver and a biologist, and I'd never heard that there were manta rays in Florida. So I did some researching online and found that no one had ever studied this manta ray population, which was really unique because they're big, charismatic megafauna, and usually scientists love to study those, or people love to interact with them. So just finding this population that was unstudied kind of led me to starting this project.
Where do you usually find them? What's their normal habitat?
So we're looking mostly in Palm Beach County, and we're looking really close to the shore. We do surveys kind of going north and south between Boynton Beach and Jupiter.
So you cited in your research that these manta rays were juveniles. How'd you find out their age?
So when we find a manta ray on one of our surveys, we get in the water to photograph that unique spot pattern on each manta ray's belly. And while we're doing that, we also look at their pelvic fins. And if the manta ray is a male, they'll have these paired reproductive structures called claspers. And based on the relative size of these claspers, you can tell if the male is sexually mature or not. So all of the males that we see here in South Florida have very, very small claspers, indicative of very young manta rays.
So, Jessica, what does it suggest to you that you have this many young manta rays living so close to our shores? What does that say?
It says that this is an important developmental habitat. We don't know a lot about the juvenile life history of manta rays. There's very few populations around the world where juveniles are regularly sighted, much less exclusively sighted like we see here. So it's really interesting. We have no idea how long they're spending in these nursery habitats, exactly how they're using them, or even how big this nursery habitat is. So we've answered some of the beginning questions, but we have a lot more to learn about them.
Looking at some of the research, I saw that, you know, manta rays are really social creatures, and that, like, the female manta rays build long-term relationships with each other, right?
Yeah, well, so that was actually the social lives of manta rays was actually done by some of my colleagues in Indonesia. And here we see mantas being social mostly when they're feeding. So when we see a group of manta rays together, usually it's because there's some kind of food resource there. But what's interesting about manta rays is that they have the largest brain relative to their body size of any fish. So they don't just have a large brain because they're big, they have a large brain for being such a big animal. So that leads us to think that they are very smart, and they probably use this big brain to navigate social interactions.
What are the threats that they face being here in South Florida?
Yeah, here in South Florida, they have to coexist with the millions of people that are using this coast. So we see about a quarter of our manta rays entangled in fishing line. This can be a problem if the fishing line gets wrapped around their body and inhibits their ability to swim or to feed. We also see them hit by boats. We'll see them with propeller scars or injuries on their backs, which can obviously be really damaging to the manta ray.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, when we talk about manatees, we always talk about, you know, boat accidents and how many are killed by boats. Is that usually what we see with the manta rays? Is that the biggest threat?
Yeah, so we're not really documenting too many manta ray mortalities. This is probably because they're negatively buoyant. So they sink when they die, and their body is made out of cartilage, so it decomposes really quickly. So that's one of the questions we have. We're not really sure what the mortality rate of these mantas are, because in general, it's very rare to have mantas strand on the beach like you would see a sea turtle or a manatee.
You know, one of the things, obviously, you know, here in Florida is that we understand the danger we pose to certain species. And so, especially with manatees, you know, we have signs. We know some of the areas where they're at, so we have signs to remind people, you know, hey, manatees in this area, be careful. Do you think we have to do that with manta rays, or you know, what do we have to do for people just to understand, like, look, you might see this out here, and again, you know, be careful with your interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we're working on at the moment. Actually, by the end of this month, we should have signs at a lot of the fishing piers and inlet jetties about what to do if you see a manta ray. We want to recruit fishermen to be citizen scientists and help us collect data when they see manta rays, and also to reel in their fishing lines when they see one, because it seems a lot of the time the mantas are swimming into the fishing hooks that are just set out. And we're going to work on an awareness campaign with boaters to just maintain vigilance while you're out on your boat. You know, a 6 to 10 foot manta ray that's jet black on the surface usually stands out pretty well. So people, if they are, just take a look around, and when they see one, slow down, because there might be more in the area. I think that could help a lot.
Are manta rays dangerous to humans?
No, they are completely harmless to humans. They have teeth, but they're very, very, very small, and they don't use them to feed. They eat plankton out of the water, so the very, very tiny organisms. And they do not have a stinging barb like stingrays, so they don't have any way that they can hurt you.
And that's the thing I think people may not know, is like, okay, there's a difference between the manta ray and the stingray, so not as to not confuse them. Is it easy to it is easy to tell the difference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The manta rays are going to be very dark in coloration. They're going to be black, and they're always going to be swimming throughout the water. You'll see them on the surface a lot. The stingrays, you're usually going to find in the sand. And then the key thing is to look for those fins coming off the face.
You actually are hoping people can help you. They can report it. If they see them, they can actually help track them and report it, right?
Yeah, that's really important, because basically I'm the first person collecting data on these manta rays in South Florida. So everything we're learning right now is new. So people who see a manta ray, even if you're walking on the beach or paddleboarding or fishing, just knowing when and where those manta rays are helps us learn about this nursery habitat and how big it is. And if you are a scuba diver or someone in the water who happens to see one, and you get a photo of that belly spot pattern that we're talking about, then we can see if it's an individual that we know in that database.
That was Jessica Pate, founder and lead scientist of the Florida Manta Project at the Marine Megafauna Foundation. And yes, you can help this threatened species by reporting your own sightings. If you see a manta ray, you can record the location and time. If you have a camera, take a picture, upload that information to the global database. It's mantamatcher.org. Again, mantamatcher.org. You can find this information and some manta ray photos on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, that's our program for this Monday, September 28th. Sundial Senior Producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. The theme music, by the way, comes from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo. Find them online, gopalo.com. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, there is a special school board meeting tomorrow that will be beginning at 1 p.m. Florida's education commissioner has called for the school district to reopen by October 5th or provide exemptions on a school-by-school basis. It will be broadcast on our 91.3 FM in Broward and Miami-Dade counties, but if you live in Palm Beach, down in the Keys, or you listen online, we still have the program for you. We'll keep you updated on the state's Phase 3 reopening, plus a panel conversation about this month's Sundial Book Club pick, The Last Train to Key West, and a talk about the hurricane of 1935. Now, come on, I've got to say it because, you know, this is an exciting time to be a sports fan in South Florida. Let's start with the really surprising one. The Miami Marlins are in the playoffs. Yeah, you heard me right. The Marlins are in the playoffs. They start a three-game series with the Chicago Cubs on Wednesday in the afternoon. And then, of course, the Miami Heat returning to the NBA Finals. And who do they play but the Los Angeles Lakers, led by that guy who used to play here, LeBron James. That game, game one, is Wednesday night. Good luck to our teams, the Marlins and the Heat, as they move forward. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.